Hi, I'm Vernon Trauner for Optometry Times, and this is 10 questions for Michelle Andrews, OD, Senior Director, North America, Professional and Academic Affairs at Cooper Vision.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Rochester, New York, and actually a town called Greece, New York, which sits right up on Lake Ontario.
What did your parents do?
My father worked in a kitchen cabinet manufacturing company. So he made kitchen cabinets and countertops. And my mom was a nurse.
Oh, so that's your tie into a medical career, maybe?
You know, it's not. My mom was a nurse. She did not have her bachelor's degree. She obtained her nursing degree with a diploma at the time. And it was funny because she really felt like women didn't have a lot of choices. I guess she felt she didn't have a lot of choices. And it was funny because growing up, neither of my parents graduated from college. And so their message to us was, I have two brothers, and their message to all three of us was, we don't care what you do. Just go to college. You can do anything you want. But we'd really like you to get your degree, and that will give you more choices than we had. But I was the only daughter. And so my mom would come to me and she'd say, now for you, I don't care what you do. You can do anything you want, but just don't be a nurse or a teacher, because those are the only two choices I had. So I really want you to venture out and see if you can do something more than be a nurse or a teacher. Which is so interesting, because I think probably I would have been a great teacher. And I find myself gravitating toward those teaching moments really in every role that I've had. But I think the inspiration to do something different was really her just wanting me to have options that she felt she didn't have.
So how did you go from a degree in communications and journalism into optometry?
Yeah, so I was in undergrad studying to have a degree in communications, and we had required science courses at the school I went to. And I think it was probably, gosh, I want to say 19 or 20 at the time. I was in my sophomore year of undergrad, and I was in biology class, and I couldn't see the board. And this is kind of funny now to think about it, but I had never had an eye exam. And so I went to get my first eye exam at that point and just fell in love with the process. And so I went back to school, went to my biology teacher and said, do you know anything about this field of optometry? And as it turns out, she was also the school's pre-professional advisor. And she said, absolutely, let me tell you all about it. And so I shifted gears from that eye exam in my sophomore year of school.
Can I go a little further? What drew you to industry instead of going into a private practice?
Yeah, so I actually did go to private practice first. When I finished optometry school and finished my residency, I did go back into private practice. I worked with a number of ophthalmology groups and built my practice within theirs. And so the journey to industry was kind of a long one. And I don't really think that I had my eyes set on industry or had that target. But, you know, you find yourself in different places across your career, and the opportunity presented itself. And having done a number of different things, industry was something that I was certainly familiar with, but had never really had really stepped into. And it was really a great opportunity at the right time to see if I could bring my knowledge of the industry and my knowledge of practice to a manufacturing company. It's been a great fit.
What's something your colleagues don't know about you?
Oh, let's see. Something my colleagues don't know about me is that So the first thing my colleagues probably don't know about me is that when I retire, I would love to open up a cheese shop. Cheese is my favorite food. Yeah, so when I retire, that's what I want to do. I want to open a cheese shop, and I think that'd be fun. The other thing they probably don't know about me is I'm fascinated with home remodeling, and if I could build one more house, I think between all the HGTV shows that I've watched and all of the different homes and apartments that I've lived in over the years, I think I've got one more. I think I've got one more build in me. One more project.
So why a cheese shop?
Yeah, so many years ago, I traveled with my husband to the UK, and we visited this amazing cheese shop in a little town in the countryside. It was a vacation that we planned where we had a flight in, a flight out, and nothing else planned in the middle. And we rented a car, and we just looked at the map and said, let's go here. And we found ourselves in the middle of the country somewhere and happened upon this cheese shop. And it had always been a favorite food of mine, but just going in and experiencing it that way in a place that was just dedicated to it, and the expertise of everyone that worked there, and just the fun of trying new and different things, it stuck with me. And I decided then that when my career in eye care was finished, that would be something that I would really love to be able to do.
So does that require you to move to Wisconsin then?
Definitely, at least a field trip for sure.
Oh, okay. Are you thinking about selling wine in this place as well?
Well, I think you could expand into lots of things. I think you can do wine, you can do olives and bread. I think you can probably do parties.
You're drifting into catering and restaurants. And
I think so. I think.
Good thing you're good at planning. You should probably get started.
Exactly. Yeah, it's still in the dreaming phase, but the ideas are definitely there.
So what's the best thing about working at CooperVision?
Yeah, the best thing about working at CooperVision is definitely the people and the culture. When I think about different opportunities that have come my way over the course of my career and just different things that you have the opportunity to participate in, and to be able to work in an environment with people who are so supportive and who are really focused on the right things. They're really focused on getting the best product to our customers, treating our customers right, and the people I work with really do invest a lot in doing what we can to do it right. And that means a lot, because when I went into this profession, I certainly went into it with the best of intentions for my patients. And you try to continuously make the right decisions. And being affiliated with a group that has that first and foremost has been extremely rewarding and is definitely the best part about working with Cooper.
Now, as I mentioned, you're in Chicago, not Rochester or Pleasanton, California, the company offices. How does your working remotely from corporate HQ affect staying looped and productive?
Yeah, so that was definitely part of our discussion when I joined the organization. You know, growing up in Rochester, we actually anticipated moving back, and then just because of my husband's work, we couldn't make that move. And it has actually worked out extremely well. As you mentioned, we have offices in Victor, New York. We have offices in Pleasanton, California. And we have an entire sales force and support group that are scattered across the country. And in fact, the professional and academic affairs team is also operating remotely. And so it actually has worked out very well. Certainly in the first year that I was with Cooper, I spent quite a bit of time on the road in Victor and Pleasanton, but also traveling throughout the country, meeting with customers, meeting with different groups, getting to know people and what they liked about Cooper, what they were looking for Cooper to do for them. And I think once you establish those relationships, it's much easier to continue the conversation remotely. I do continue to spend a lot of time with our team at Cooper and with our customers, and that will continue. But it has really been seamless.
Yeah, that point about developing the relationship is really important. Seems that a lot of companies are rather wary of that. They prefer people chatting at the water cooler, as it were.
Well, you know, and you do miss things at the water cooler. And so, you know, a big part of not being at the water cooler is certainly understanding that those conversations exist and that you'll miss those, and that's just a part of it. and you have a responsibility to get caught up and make sure you're connected to those conversations, however you get connected to them. The worst thing you can do is take those things personally, because they happen. But I think the stronger the relationship you have with the folks that you work with, then they're more likely to draw you in and make sure that you have that information.
What are an optometry practice's best practices?
We started a best practices program 2 years ago. We're now going into our third year. And the program was started to really recognize those practices who are doing amazing things every single day. And even in the environment that we operate in, which right now is very dynamic, it can be very challenging, these doctors and their practices, they have found a way to not just survive, but really thrive and keep growing. And one of the things we realized a few years ago was that there really wasn't a way to identify these practices, formalize their recognition, but then also share those ideas with the entire industry. And so it was from that that best practices was born. You know, what are people doing that can help elevate and help the rest of the profession, help their peers? Because likely people are struggling with the same things. And it just seemed like a great way to connect the optometric community with each other.
I know it's kind of hard to peg down a laundry list of best practices that will give you success, but can you give me three?
Yeah. The first one is that these best practices, what we're seeing is that they have a business plan. They have an identity that they feel very strongly about, and they are not going to deviate from who they are in terms of how they've identified that practice. And what they all do is they seek to get better, and they seek to expand and to incorporate things that will make their identity richer and make their practice better for their patients, but they don't seek to change who they are. That was something that was really impressive to me, is that we now have 20 people, 20 practices in the program. We'll be selecting 10 more this year, but all 20 are very, very different. And when they all came together, they pulled ideas from each other, not to change who they were, but to enhance who they are. And so the first thing is they know who they are, and they're seeking to improve and make that better, but not to change. The second thing I would say is they really embrace and value and invest in their staff. And it all looks different, but everybody really wants to talk about how they support their staff. It's interesting, in our program, we give them the opportunity to talk about different subject areas. And each year, each group gets to vote on the topics that they want to talk about the most. And each year, the topics were different, with the exception of staff. Both groups wanted to talk about staff and wanted to learn, what are you doing? How do you make it work? What investments do you make? How do you do it? And so that is a very common topic. And when we went to present their awards, every practice had their entire staff there. Their staff was part of it, and every owner said, I wouldn't be here without my team, and I want my team to participate in this. Very consistent emphasis on the value of staff. I think the final thing that they all have in common is that they just have an attitude that we can do this, that no matter what comes in their way, or something that would maybe be taken by someone else as, oh, here's another reason we can't be successful. These doctors look at those things and say, well, that's interesting. What can I learn from that, and what can I do with that? Or if they see a trend coming, they say, what can I do to get ahead of that? They don't seem to be afraid of those challenges, but rather they look at them and find something in themselves to say, all right, if that's the way this is going to go, if this is the direction this is going to take, then what can I do? What can I do with that? What can I do because of it? And it almost seems like they're inspired by those things rather than being demotivated by them. Many of the groups that have been selected are expanding. They're adding offices. They're adding space. They're either, you know, adding to their current location or adding a second or third location. And they just see opportunity everywhere.
Instead of going hopeless and all floppy in front of a challenge, they turn it into an opportunity then, or a tool.
They do. They do. They look at it and they seem to be able to say, okay, how does that fit or not fit with my practice? How does this fit with my customer or not fit with my customer? What's driving this? You know, is this a customer-driven trend? You know, and if customers are looking for something like this, well, then are my customers looking for that? And they're very deliberate about understanding what those things are and how they fit. And so if it's something that they say, you know what, this doesn't fit with my practice, I'm not going to worry about it, they move past it. If they think they need to do something or incorporate something different, then they come up with a plan and they do it. But they don't fall into either the victim cycle or that downward spiral that sometimes you see other people falling into.
How do you integrate your private and your professional lives?
So, yeah, I have two children, and I'm married, and we have a very, very active life. And I would say that it's very messy. Maybe it's a controlled chaos, but I don't try to balance it. I don't, and I know a lot of people talk about work-life balance, but I have an amazing family who we communicate frequently about our choices. And, you know, my husband chooses to go to work every day, and I choose to go to work every day, and my children have chosen their extracurricular activities of choice. And so we all come at it from a place of, this is what I have chosen to do. And so what do you have to do? What do we all have to do to make those things happen? And some days we do it really well, and some days we don't. There are some weeks where my investment in work is much more significant than perhaps my investment in home, and vice versa. And so that's what I mean when I don't look for balance. I look at, these are all the decisions we've made and the things that we all want to do, and this is what we all have to do to make them happen. And we kind of reassess. You know, when we have one of those weeks when the wheels come off, we'll sit down and talk about it and say, wow, do we need to make a change? You know, does something need to change here? And ultimately, the group seems to come together and say, no, we're okay. We've got this, and it helps, too, that sometimes we've just acknowledged that it's messy sometimes, and it's hard sometimes, and not everything is happy, but that's just part of it. You know, we wish every project was on schedule, and we wish we won every game, and we wish every practice ended on time, but they don't, and I think we all have just gotten good at understanding that. And things happen, we just do the best we can to work through them. I think if it all got too overwhelming, we would make a different choice. But right now, that just hasn't happened yet. One of the things that I've come to appreciate that is my children are learning, rightly or wrongly, that things happen. And things don't always go according to plan. And they're learning how to navigate that. You know, when they forget something at school, they have to then go and be responsible for that. And they have to explain to their teacher what they forgot and why, or they have to explain to the coach what they forgot and why. And I think they're learning a couple things. First of all, they're learning some responsibility for those things, which hopefully will help them as they grow up and have bigger responsibilities. But they're also learning what consequences. You know, sometimes you get so wound up about, oh my goodness, what's going to happen? And so they're learning at a young age what consequence means. And, you know, my daughter's in fifth grade, so there's not a whole lot of super significant consequence in fifth grade. And so I think it's a nice time for her to learn what exactly happens if you don't turn in your homework? And what happens the next day? And what happens if you forget a certain part of your uniform or a certain, you know, part of your practice gear? What happens? They're learning to rely on other people. They're learning to face those challenges at a young age. And I think that will serve them well. I mean, obviously, no parent wants their child to have a lot of that. And my children may have more than others whose parents can bring those things to them. But for us, I see two children who are growing up to be very responsible, very accountable, and they're learning where their limits are and what kinds of